Guardian Unlimited.
My name's John Mullen, and I'm talking to Will Self for the Guardian Book Club. Will, perhaps he doesn't need any introduction, I don't know. The opening, he must have got somebody to write his Wikipedia entry.
I didn't.
No? Well, whoever wrote it, it's a good one. It begins with the words, highly articulate. Usually begins, people's entries begin with stuff about where they were born and stuff, but Will starts highly articulate. And if you're an academic, you kind of watch Will's performances on TV with kind of rankling admiration, self-rankling admiration, because I think he's the only person I've heard splatter Richard Littlejohn all over the studio walls. I don't know if you remember this encounter.
Oh, yes, no, I remember that vividly because, like a lot of bigots and, sort of people who advocate physical force to settle things, he's a physical coward. So, it's difficult to forget a quaking, pusillanimous, proto-fascist like that, shaking.
Well, I remember, but I might have got this wrong, I remember... Will described this Richard Littlejohn book, which I haven't read, as a right wing, a kind of Tom Sharp for the far right, and that he'd read on the basis of having read the first 200 pages of it. And Richard Littlejohn said, you haven't read the book in its totality. And I do remember Will said, why does it turn into Tolstoy at page 205? And then amazingly, Richard Littlejohn, and I looked at the transcript of this because I thought my memory might have cheated me. Richard Littlejohn said, no, it doesn't turn into Tolstoy. I don't set out to be Tolstoy. It's a much more complex book than that.
It was a...
one of the great literary encounters.
It was a memorable joust, but he felt that he'd been set up in some way because... He felt he'd been teed up or set up, and he hadn't had the opportunity to read this book. In fact, I don't know what he would have made of it. I don't think I care.
Well, we're here to talk about The Book of Dave, and I suppose, that most of you will be familiar with it, but I guess I should give... a sketch of it. It's subtitled A Revelation of the Recent Past and the Distant Future. It's kind of divided. It's 16 chapters alternate between two sort of time zones. One is the recent past, where Dave Rudman, a cabbie, goes seethingly mad on the page. His madness especially... His mad anger directed especially at his estranged wife. And the other chapter set some time in centuries in the future after a flood which has left bits of England scarcely recognisable and bits of English also scarcely recognisable, and where a future population reduced to kind of quite a primitive existence... console themselves with a religion which has been fabricated on the basis of Dave's book, The Book of Dave, his enraged fulminations against the world and particularly, I think, against the female sex. And Will extrapolates a whole kind of anthropology, a whole religion based on this kind of... this extraordinary book. And I guess, I wanted to start with actually a question about the idea of the catastrophe of remaking a world after some sort of imagined catastrophic event which has kind of almost ended civilization, and why that's a kind of a couple of book clubs ago we looked at, we had Margaret Atwood talking about Oryx and Crake, which is a post-catastrophe novel. And since writing the first column on your book, I've had some of the readers have written into the website, kind of, and with comparisons between it and other post-catastrophe novels, like I don't know if you know Russell Hoban's Ridley Walker. What was it that kind of attracted you to that sort of conceit?
Well, I think it's going to happen. I think that it's really only in the post-Enlightenment era, which is mere 250-odd years, that humanity has collectively developed the delusion of sustainable progress. And prior to that, not only in fact, but also in thought, nobody presumed that civilizations were going to endure indefinitely. So I think it's, you know, at least part of the aim of writing post-apocalyptic fiction is to draw people's attention to the fact that history is circular, that what goes around comes around. That's it, really. I really don't believe that people are going to be sitting here in the Guardian Book Club year in, year out, till the last trump is sounded and the plague pits open up and tattered skeletons walk up and down the Farringdon Road. I just don't think that's going to happen.
And you, what about the it gives you the opportunity to kind of do, I guess, what lots of reviewers, I suppose, but also I think just readers as well, notice as one of the distinctive things about the book, something it has in common with that Russell Hoban novel, is that the denizens of this future world, or most of them, speak in a kind of remade language.
Yeah.
And however kind of grim the thought of an apocalypse might be, I mean, it looks like you had quite a lot of kind of pleasure in remaking that language. Is that wrong?
Up to a point. I mean, language is, it's not an invented language. It's certainly not. It's not like Burgess's Nasdat in Clockwork Orange, which is really a sort of Argo of Russian and some neologisms. It's not, to my mind, and I'm not sort of indulging in false modesty because it's not really my style, it's not as impressive an invented language as Hoban's in Ridley Walker. I mean, I wrote the introduction to the reissue of Ridley Walker a few years ago, and it was interesting how many people came out of the woodwork and said, oh, this is an amazing, amazing book. And when I published, Dave said, how dare you sort of tread the same hallowed ground as Russell Hoban. And in fact, Ridley Walker had been out of print for over a decade, so I don't know who these great Ridley Walker fans were. They certainly weren't buying Russell's books, that's for sure. But I think that what he did in Ridley Walker is to create a kind of, and actually his afterword to that book is a masterful excursus on the whole idea of invented languages. What he did was to take English as a kind of nuclear isotope and look at what would happen when it deteriorated, when it had a kind of half-life. And as Ridley Walker is a post-nuclear apocalypse novel, that was rather amazing. I may say, I don't think I'm a slouch when it comes to reading, but it's an extremely tough book to read if you do try and read it, and I'm not sure it would find a publisher today. And I kind of rather, I really don't know that it necessarily would. I rather wimped out on going as far as Hoban did. His book is entirely written in this deteriorated English, which is really quite tricky to get to terms with. I considered writing all of the future sections in a kind of version of that my own, and I kind of slightly wimped out on it. I mean, I couldn't, for a start, it would be technically difficult to do the kind of, to express the kind of philosophic and satiric ideas that I wanted to get across in the novel. But also, I'm not sure that the contemporary reader, who's, after all, largely fed on kind of tit of rather facile English a lot of the time, will stomach it. I mean, the amount of kind of comment on, some from yourself, John, on on what people presume is recondite vocabulary is really quite astonishing nowadays. And if you look at something like Ridley Walker, That's a, what would you say about that? It's a fantastically difficult book, yeah. Far more difficult than my invented language, which is only a phoneticised Cockney. That's well, all there is
I did say that actually I was disappointed that, in a way, that you'd provide the glossary at the end, because I was
You can blame Tony Lacey,
who's
Tony's sitting
fault,
over
is
there.
Because I was just getting the hang, I was getting really fluent
I agree
in
with
Cockney.
You. I agree with you. The glossary was written for the copy editor, who obviously needed to kind of know when words were being used consistently. Though, of course, there are some irregularities in the Mockney, as there are in any language. But it was quite, you know, I'm not going to don her as a superb copy editor, and it was quite a tricky text to edit in that way, and she needed a primer, for particularly for the coinages and the neologisms in the language, or in the dialect. And then it was felt that... by Tony, that perhaps it might be an idea to leave it in for the more. Yeah. I think, you know, I think it's quite easy for us, if anybody's read the book or is thinking of reading the book or is in the process of reading the book, I think it's a bit like Irvin Welsh's phoneticised Scots demotic, in that once you, if you have an ear for it, I think it probably leaps straight off the page. To a reader in Malmo or, you know, Minneapolis, it may be a bit harder. And indeed, my French translator, who's been with me for a decade and a half, has resigned.
But it has a weird effect, which I presume you were kind of, you thought about quite carefully when you're reading it, certainly when you're first reading it, which is that the bits where people are speaking in Mockney, you can always work out what they're saying, but you have to kind of read it slower. Then you can't just, so it goes, because, well, I can't tell you what it looks like, but you have to read it like this. And they used their bare bloody hands to do it. They were that bloody strong and hard. That's what he says.
Yeah, I mean, I for some reason don't have that kind of problem. But there you go. I mean, I see whether I can... I'm going to go on a bit, Simon called to the rest of the gang. See if there's anything better over there. And Fred called back, yeah, all right, but not afar. You know, I mean, it's Cockney. It's just very broad Cockney.
I know, because...
It looks... What surprised me, I mean, it's got some things like I've sort of interpolated some text messaging.
And you use umlauts.
I use diacritical marks as well. And what it ends up looking like, I think, on the page is surprisingly Chaucerian.
Yes.
I mean, it begins to look like Middle English, which I think, you know, what it tells you is that English is still Middle English in that way. You know, that the basic language we speak, shorn of Latinisms and shorn of a certain amount of loanwords that have come to us since the 14th century, remains surprisingly consistent as a language in that way.
And Dave... But Dave doesn't kind of... He doesn't speak Cockney, really, does he?
No, he's
He can do. He can do when the occasion
I think
demands.
He's like a lot of us. I think he's got... He's free-floating. You know, I think it says very early on in the book that he's kind of thrown his... He's dropped his consonants like ninja stars. He's sort of flung them away from him. I mean, he is a London cabbie. He lives in that... to some extent in that milieu in the East End, and it's kind of, you know, he speaks the prevailing dialect, but, you know, his mother's a teacher, his father's a kind of chancer, a sort of sub Le Carré kind of washed up kind of businessman, and, you know, he comes essentially from a kind of lower middle class suburban background, but who doesn't? I know I do.
And did you choose a cabbie partly because, I mean, when we meet him right at the beginning, he's sort of stewing in traffic in this kind of metal box. And, I mean, was it partly that, because there's a lot about how angry he is and the consequences of the logic of his anger. I mean, was it partly because driving in London would be enough to drive anybody into
I was gifted Dave by the premise of the novel rather than having the character and then looking for a terrain for him to inhabit. I mean, what I was interested in was this idea of who would best preserve the memory of the city if it was destroyed, if it was flooded. And I was fascinated by that idea primarily, and by the fact, I think, that large cities are much, much, particularly London, which is after all 2 millennia old and is notably unplanned for a major metropolis. And I was very intrigued by, you know, I think of London as being the creation of sort of not terribly efficient social insects. I mean, I think that's the best way of looking at it as a city. And of course, none of us really hold or apprehend the totality of the city. It's largely unplanned. Its administrations overlap and leave large gaps. There's no, you know, Ken Livingstone certainly doesn't know what's going on in London in any meaningful sense. Tony Blair wouldn't know London if it bit him on the arse. I mean, it's just a non-apprehensible, the great when, you know, the only, and then it kind of came to me that the only person who could conceivably in any sense be said to hold the city was a London cabbie who has this phenomenal knowledge, you know, every street within a 6 mile radius of Charing Cross, every notable building, a considerable amount of the suburbs. So the cabbie came to me like that, but then of course, you know, I realised that he was perfect for it. There's this enormous, you know, looming stereotype of the London taxi driver as the sort of bigot, the kind of, you know, which, I mean, the guy who helped me, every line of this book has been passed by an authentic London cabbie, and in fact, the cabbie who helped me with the book and who I went out with in the cab to kind of get a feel for the trade is also a psychotherapist. So I don't really think I think, like a lot of stereotypes, that one, you know, is stereotypes are so easy, aren't they? And part of the fun of creating Dave as a character was to both play to the stereotype and play against it, I think, you know. And he's my Bloom. I mean, he's an everyman for me. He's not just a kind of ranting traffic oppressed bigot, but he is those things too.
Yeah, yeah. And you follow, I mean, we follow him to some extent, particularly when we first meet him, and when we follow him on the, what they call points and runs, and we go from Park Lane up to Mill Hill and back again, and out to Heathrow Airport and up to Hampstead, and we go on those runs. And I mean, it seems like a kind of in those bits, it reminded me of other sort of kind of great satirical books which take describing London as sort of part of their method, like, I don't know, like Money maybe, or like No, don't like Money. Well, anyway,
I think Money is a great novel, yeah, but I don't think that Martin knows where he is in London a lot of the time. I mean, it's not actually. Money is jump cuts between Bayswater, Notting Hill, and Heathrow. I mean, I love the book. I love him. I'm not trying to knock him, but what I was trying to do in Dave was actually write. You can take this novel, and you could find your way around London with it. I mean, it is, to my way of thinking, it's a novel. You know, when Nabokov lectured on literature at Cornell, you know, if he was lecturing on Mansfield Park, he'd draw a diagram of the floor plan of Mansfield Park. If he was lecturing on Proust, he'd draw the two ways at Combray. You know, that he had. You know, for me, it's enormously important that fiction has that kind of sense of topography, and that it's kind of, without being too nerdish about it, though I am a frantic nerd, it has to be precise in that way. So, as I say, I'm not knocking those books, but I can't think of, you know, I read, pick up novels that are kind of London novels, and they kind of aren't London novels, actually, in my way of thinking. They're often not that precise. I mean, I suppose, you know, somebody who is even more precise than me would be Ian Sinclair, possibly, you know, to a kind of millimetric level.
Well, I was thinking, I suppose, I take the point about the precision or imprecision. I was thinking about the kind of, that sort of paradox. I don't know, if you want another comparison, you get it in something like the Dunciad as well. That you're seeing London, and you're seeing London in this extraordinarily kind of jaundiced way, in a way. But also that there's a kind of there's a kind of enthusiasm or love of it.
Oh, enormous enthusiasm. I mean, for me, ambivalence. I mean, London is my muse more than any other, and I'm very wedded to it fictionally. And I tried to escape it in the 1990s and moved out of town. And I'm kind of very much resolved funny enough, you know, writing this novel was a you know, it's a love letter to the city in that way. I mean, and for me, powerful ambivalent feelings are very romantic feelings. I mean, to not feel negative about the object of your love seems to me a very strange thing, because they enthral you so much and ensorcel you in that way.
I sort of thought, here at last is somebody kind of doing justice to Colindale, and although it's a kind of dark kind of justice, but you know, to those, that the particular route between Kilburn and Colindale, which is a feature of the...
Yeah. I mean, I'm that's my kind of that's my kind of layer of the dendrochronology of London. I mean, that's the circle I grew up in. So you know, I'm particularly interested, I suppose, in kind of interwar suburbia. You know, that's where my heart lies.
So does that mean when you're sort of with Dave, we're with Dave in his cab, and he's sort of, he's kind of furious in various ways, and he's divided between the things he might be saying to his fares and the things that in italics he's actually thinking. That we're sort of, that there's a sense in which we're kind of with his anger as well as sort of...
Yeah, I mean, yes and no. I mean, it's very, yes. Yes, I think so. I mean, there's lots of little tropes that he comes up with that, you know... He's got a ready line about every kind of subgroup.
Because he's kind of observant as well as bigoted, isn't he?
Yeah, he sees it all. He registers the city. And bigotry, I mean, I'm very puzzled by... There seems to me that people read novels a lot because they want... you know, there's this word that occurs again and again, and it occurred in the critiques of this novel, that there was more... I can't even say the word... upsets me so much. There was more redemption in this book.
And I was thinking, thank God, I was just waiting to hear a word I'd used in one, but it wasn't.
and I think there's a great desire in people who read fiction or to find redemption in narrative. You know, what we like in novels is we tee up a character or a set of characters, and you know, either they do bad shit or bad shit happens to them, or you know, and then kind of things go along a bit. And I'm not saying it's a great happy ending, but there's some kind of resolution, there's some catharsis, there's some redemption in there at the end of it. And you know, that's not my experience of life at all. You know, my experience of life is very different. And by the same token, you know, when people want characters often in fiction to be, to my way of thinking, more stereotypic morally than they are themselves, you know, that we cleave to an idea or to an ideation of what people are in narrative fiction that it doesn't really reflect what we're like. And that's why I'm uneasy with that word bigoted. I think that everybody, it can be fearful in life, everyone. And when people are fearful, they lash out at other people, and they lash out at other people for false reasons. They categorize people by their color or by their religion or by their class, and people do it all the bloody time, day in, day out. Bigotry sounds monolithic to me. To me, it's the 400,000 little blows of ill feeling that exist in people's days, and he has more than most of them. He's not really a bigot. I mean, you know, he has a black friend. He's half Jewish himself. He's not. He's just like us. It's just that I often think that people look in the mirror of fiction, and if they see Caliban looking back at them, they become rather enraged because they don't want to know about that.
There's two. I wanted to ask you about the two. I guess what seemed to me to be the two obvious topics of satire in the novel, and what the kind of connection is between the two, and what one seems to me to be the thing we'd already kind of mentioned, religion, I suppose, or revealed religion, or a religion made up out of completely misunderstood bits and pieces, literally just dug up, and then
like Christianity, for example, which is a religion made up out of bits and pieces of stuff.
You know, but like the Christianity of a different age or a different place.
Like the Christianity of now. Like the religious right in the States who are in cahoots with the pro-Israel lobby at this very moment and making this world a fucking misery. Yeah, like them.
But it's also...
Their religion's made up out of rubbish.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, there's a religion, and then there's...
like the Islamists and their religion, though they have more claim to doctrinal purity than the fundamentalist Christian right. I mean, a lot of this was inspired, and I said it in the little piece I wrote for The Guardian, by several things. By a conversation with the guy who was running my local takeaway, who's an Islamist, about a kind of revelation for me about fundamentalisms of all stripes and the way in which fundamentalists view holy books, which is that they exist outside time. They are a kind of, they are the sort of encyclopedia ex machina, and that they're a book of words. They contain for the fundamentalists everything that ever will happen, everything that can happen, everything that has happened, and everything in the world relates ineluctably to that text. You know, and I think and that's a kind of absolutely key thing for these monotheistic fundamentalists in their attitude towards the text. So that was one thing. The other thing was this book I read by two Israeli archaeologists called The Bible Uncovered. And what they did was something very interesting, which was they went to find the archaeological evidence for the Pentateuch, for the Old Testament. And they set that side by side with a textual analysis of the first five books of the Bible. And you know, to my satisfaction at least, they came away... You know, I think any of us who've been brought up in the Judeo-Christian and even the Islamic tradition, slightly cleave to the idea that there's some truth in these stories, that somebody like Abraham was wandering around on the Golan Heights with a long beard and a lot of sheep behind him, that there is some truth, for example, in the stories of the exile, of the imprisonment of the Israelites in Egypt, and so on and so forth. And what these guys establish is that there's absolutely no backing for any of this. Not only that, we know when the Bible was written. We know when it was written, and we know why it was written. And we know what it was written for. And I wanted to very much write a book predicated on the idea, ruthlessly on the idea, that kind of religion is a product of state formation, that it absolutely has a strict kind of political function in that way.
So we've got these people in the future with their Davianity.
Yes.
Yeah, their Davianity. Yeah. And we've got something else in the present, which seems to me the other main topic of the satire, target of the satire, which is kind of male resentment and fury and this...
Patriarchy is what it used to be called.
But it's a particular aspect of it, isn't it? It's these men dressing up as Henry VIII or whatever and hanging off high buildings and their meetings in Swiss Cottage Sports Centre and stoking their fury.
It was a very strange historical moment as we sort of swung into the Iraq War. And on the one hand, you had Tony Blair, the daddy of the nation. I mean, I'm not saying that he and Cherie were cynical enough to conceive a child while in office in order to gain re-election. You'd have to be a real cynic to imagine that even for a second or contemplate it in any way at all, and I don't want to do that. But on the one hand, you have this astonishingly procreative mummy and daddy of the nation couple, and on the other hand, you have these young guys being sent off on a, to my way of thinking, kind of completely morally and politically unjustifiable foreign military adventure. And on the other hand, you've got this other group of men dressed up as Batman and Superman, shinnying up the outside of Parliament and claiming that they are, in some way, the repository of of masculine values. And yes, I mean, I was interested in satirizing that, exactly, you know, pointing out the idiocy and the kind of idiocy.
But also the religion of the future is based mostly upon the kind of the most furious and resentful assertions that Dave makes about kind of how women should be treated and the impossibility of men and women indeed having any kind of relationship which is not violent and unpleasant.
Well, I mean, most revealed religions do contain a really, really, really broad stripe of misogynism in their practice and their doctrine. So, I mean, that's only the way it happens, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, when, you know, you're never going to be asked to take a ritual bath by some, you know, kind of rabbi or imam, are you? I mean, it's sort of, that's the way it happens. I mean, when I say, I mean, the real object of my satire is patriarchal society. I mean, it is a society based on presumed masculine superiority.
And if the book doesn't have redemption or anything, it seemed to me to like, I fear you.
Not the R word again.
I'm not going to say redemption. I thought it had some morals, you see. I thought it had some morals. I thought, like...
Well, it does have morals. I mean, I think...
I thought it taught some lessons, almost. Is that a bad thing to think about?
I think it does have some morals, but I think that it's very bleak about where liberal humanism leads us as a credo. And it's very bleak about the idea that a human ethics is, in some sense, naturalistic and inherent in that way, as is a lot of my fiction. And I think people find that, you know, rather bitter pill to stomach. Stoicism is not a very happy attitude. I mean, it's not a light-hearted attitude. You don't often see Stoics skipping, for example.
It's probably time that I turned you over to the readers. So, is there anybody here who would like to ask about Stoicism or anything else in Will's novel? And if you stick up your hand, they then point the mic at you. But don't worry, it doesn't have to come to you. It just has to be pointed. Are we going to have some questions? Dare you? Yes.
I was interested to hear you say that your French translator had resigned. Has anybody, any of your translators, committed suicide? Because that's what I do.
Yeah, I mean, several of the Scandinavian translators have committed suicide. I don't think it relates to particularly working on my book. They do find it difficult. I mean, I think in my earlier novels, some of the things that translators have found hard is that, you know, people say, for example, of French, that Céline, you know, opened up the idea of writing in Argo in French, but the reality is that there is still a great purity about written French. There is about High German as well. I mean, they don't like the kind of mixture of Mandarin and Demotic prose that I specialise in to some extent. It doesn't appeal to translators. I mean, it's fascinating, you know, in German, you know, in some of my books that the swear words are all excised. They don't exist. So, you know, I wrote a novel which is here, How the Dead Live, which is another rather foul-mouthed protagonist. And, you know, in the German version, she sort of says, oh, golly, God, you know, sort of, you know, that's terrible. It just doesn't really have the bite of English. They're very gloomy, the translators, though. I think they're gloomy largely. I mean, François Klein has resigned over the Book of Dave. It's a very mournful man, but I think it's really because he's rather like Salieri in Amadeus. You know, whenever he sees me, he thinks, "Who is this idiot whose words I have to translate?" You know, sort of too many notes. You know, he can't, because he thinks he writes my books. He can't, when I actually appear in the flesh, he can't credit that I'm such a sort of ridiculous and immature loony, whereas he is this great and established French man of letters. But I wish him well in the afterlife.
There's a lady here.
I'd like to hear you talk a bit about the violence in it. I mean, I would like to know why, particularly in the future world, you made it so horrible the way they were on the wheel, and what was the purpose of that?
I think one of probably the most disturbing scenes in the future is the execution of the Chelish mummy who is hung on to her kids. And she's executed, of course, at Tyburn, at Marble Arch. And the description of the future execution is not verbatim, but it's a very, very accurate description of an Elizabethan execution. I mean, that's what it was like. Right down to the cats being set on fire, these effigies stuffed with cats that are then burnt at the time. So these things are just, you know, Thomas More, the great saint who, you know, personally ordered, Protestant recusants to have their tongues cut out, disemboweled and burnt on fires. This kind of thing went on day in, day out. I was reading, to go a couple of hundred or so years later, I was reading Pepys this morning. Pepys walking back from Greenwich with a man he's hired to protect him, who halfway on the walk back to the city, he suddenly becomes filled with paranoia because he thinks this man's going to beat his brains out. Another entry in Pepys I read this morning of an actor being murdered, an actor manager in the theatre having his throat cut at Kentish Town. I mean, these were... humanity's always been violent and ugly, and London's always been a violent and anarchic place. I only really think I'm reflecting these realities. I don't think if anything, I'm playing it down.
I'm just intrigued to know, I haven't read the book yet, but whether Dave ventures to South London at all.
Yes, he does venture to South London. You'll be very gratified. Are you a South Londoner?
I am, yeah.
You're from Greenwich. Well, I mean, I'm not a native South Londoner, but I have lived among you people for some years and come to learn your strange ways. I've lived in South London for the last 10 years. I've become quite partisan in my South Londonness, and I discovered recently, which filled me with great pride, that in fact the first self to come to London lived at Kennington Cross in 1840. So it turns out that I have an honourable and long-established South London pedigree, and this is reflected in the novel. There are scenes in Pett's Wood.
Yes.
I was fascinated by the sort of chat with Dave with the tipping thing with taxis, and ever since I read the book, I feel obliged to give more money to my Dave that's taken me around there, and it's cost me a lot of money. But is that something? Is that something you gleaned from the cab driver that sort of taught you? Because you know, I get in a taxi, I always feel like I'm being judged, whereas before I read the book, I never did.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. It is. It's all totally authentic. And. And, you know, I mean, I was reading this really quite good book by a Lebanese guy called Nicholas Taleb, called The Black Swan, which is a book about chance. And he repeats the old canard in this book that, you know, he keeps saying, I was going to a meeting in London and the cabbie found some traffic. You know, and, you know, the meter is calibrated for time and distance. You know, it's never in a cabbie's interest to find traffic. They don't make any more money getting gummed up in traffic than they do taking you directly there. One of the beauties of the London cab system. But no, I mean, I didn't take a lot of cabs to begin with, but writing this book has ruined the cab experience for me, I can assure you. I really don't want to get in them anymore.
Because Dave is so scathingly perceptive about the vanities of his fares that you can... I mean, there's one... I recognise one of them as being me, you know. Mm. I'm like, oh, it's the guy who says, well, actually, I think if you cut through here, you're right. And Dave's easy
That's
manner
well.
his italicised obscenities just make it, which are unspoken, make it impossible for me to think of having a conversation.
True, of course, but there are an awful lot of of taxi drivers. And as I say, they don't... I mean, one of the fascinating things about the trade is how much it's changed. I mean, very early on, Dave, of course, says, you know, now you see black cabbies, which you never used to do. I mean, in the 1960s, when I grew up in London, you know, anything up to 60% of the trade was estimated to be Jewish. You know, you barely see a Jewish cabbie from one week to the next nowadays. So, you know, the trade is quite porous and it's quite mutable in that way. And I don't think that all the cabbies are sitting there like Dave, dissecting you with the scalpel of a savage internal voice. On the other hand, I'm sure some of them are, because I think one of the foibles we have as is that we think we're hiring privacy when we get into a cab. You know, and that, of course, negates the reality of the person who's driving you. You know, and that... But that's, you know, we do that in all aspects of our life. We kind of think we're buying privacy when we buy a restaurant table. You know, there's all sorts of people in service industries that we want to pretend aren't really there, and we think we've bought them not being there by divvying up a bit of money. And I think that one of the fun things about writing the book was to turn that round and say, you know, what it's like from the point of view of somebody who is in that kind of situation. And of course, well, I don't want to give away the end of the book. But
you're allowed to do that because they're presumed to have done their homework.
He hasn't.
He hasn't, no.
Do you want us not to mention the ending, sir? Yeah.
No, but I mean that sort of epiphany around his relationship with the cab fares is what, of course, comes back to him at the very end. That is, turns out to have been, in a way, the crux of his relationship with humanity in a rather disturbing way.
Yeah, I mean, I was interested to hear that the cabbie who took you around London as part of your research for the book was also a psychotherapist, though presumably not Adam Phillips. And I don't know if you can say any more about that, like if it sort of bled into the text or anything like that, but it just sounded interesting.
Well, I can't say a great deal about it. I mean, I can assure you it's not Adam Phillips, who, for a start, like most poets, can't even drive. So he couldn't be a cabbie. He's also Jewish, which would sort of disqualify him increasingly. No, I can't say anything that would compromise the anonymity of my source, who's keen to
But the book does have psychiatrists and... in it, doesn't
as
it?
As usual.
As usual. Let's well, they stop. Get a better press than usual, actually, don't they, in this book? Then.
Yes, I mean, it's not about them.
No, I know, but he gets treatment, doesn't he? And the treatment's not entirely kind of wrong-headed or unperceptive.
No, not at all. But, I mean, that's right. But, you know, I've never taken a monolithic view of the psychiatric profession qua profession. What I've tended to satirise is what I think of in the past is what I think of... as the therapeutic state, if you like, the idea that... but perhaps I've mellowed with respect to shrinks. I mean, there are fatter fish to fry. The things that happened in respect of the guy I worked with on the book were odd. I think fiction is an odd medium. I think that, you know, when you... I mean, without in any way compromising him, I mean, I wrote things into the character of Dave that were true to him that he had never told me. And I don't know whether I inferred them in some strange and kind of vaguely psychic fashion or whether they were just in there to be called in. But beyond that, no, I mean, what I took from him was the kind of the bare bones of what the trade's like. And privacy, well, it's an inverted service industry, if you like, because, you know, of course, when you hire a psychotherapist, you're paying for a lack of privacy. It's the inversion of getting into a cab. You know, you're paying to dump your emotional guts on the floor of their room. Mind you, I always love that Little Britain sketch where they go out of the therapist's room and the therapist is immediately on the phone.
Yes! You know, yes, prostitutes! Yeah.
We all know that's true.
Could you explain a little about the motos?
Oh, yeah, I wanted to ask about the motos.
No, I can't really explain much about the motos. They're one of those things that are, you know, in part they came from... I wrote a story years ago for a collection called Tough Tough Toys for Tough Tough Boys called Caring Sharing, which was about these neurotic kind of kidult Manhattanites, none of whom had children and all of whom were kind of revolving in some ceaseless kind of eternal kind of 20-something relationships and everything. And what they had was these creatures called Emotos, which were kind of genetically engineered giants about 14 feet high who kind of walked around with them. And whenever these people were feeling neurotic or insecure, they'd sort of go, cuddle, and the Emotos would pick them up and give them a sort of cuddle and stroke their hair. And I was intrigued by the idea and it got, of kind of... I'm generally intrigued by the idea of anthropoid species that are not human, because, of course, we, you know, for most of our existence, there were other anthropoids, other human species around. It's written into our folklore. It's in Lord of the Rings. You know, it seems to me that that could come about again. You know, these are the kind of mechanics of having something like the Motos, who are obviously some kind of accident of genetic engineering. At another level, I wanted something on the island of Ham to represent the loss of their relationship with their children. You know, and the Motos are quite sort of multivalent creatures in that way. They both do the business of representing this severed connection with children, and at the same time, representing the strength of rural people's connection with nature. And the whole opening sequence, the slaughter sequence of the Moto, is more or less lifted straight from Laura Ingalls Wilder's Little House in the Big Woods, which I urge you to read. It has an amazing description of slaughtering the family pig in the opening, intensely graphically written, really graphic, right down to the end where Pa takes the pig's bladder and washes it in a trough of water and blows it up, ties it off and gives it to the little girls to play with as a balloon. And I thought, I was reading this to one of my children, I thought, this is an astonishing and vivid portrayal of what it's like when you really live with nature, when you're not denatured in that way. So I wanted the Motos to do all of those things. I wanted them to be a kind of a way of commenting on those things.
I found that pretty. I mean, the lady earlier asked about the sort of execution scene in New London. I found the Moto execution pretty, or slaughtering, pretty skin prickling and horrible, actually. And that sort of they're sort of reared kind of to be willing to go along with this in some kind of way.
Yeah. Well, of course, that's the view. I mean, it's very... I mean, I was on watching Newsnight last night and there was a terribly nice lady up in Northumberland talking about how dreadful it was when Diffid came along and slaughtered her lovely flock of sheep because of foot and mouth and how none of them had foot and mouth. But she was going to slaughter them anyway. I mean, let's not get carried... You know, and it's fascinating. But that shows you how kind of ruckled the terrain. Once you start having relationships with animals... whatever kind, it shows you how kind of complex those relationships can be, and how, you know, you can have an intense and warm relationship with an animal that you know you're going to kill. There's nothing necessarily wrong with that, it strikes me. I mean, the odder and more peculiar thing is going to an enormous chilled barn and looking at plastic wrapped portions of animals that have been carved up in an abattoir in Leuven, in Belgium. I mean, that seems intrinsically stranger to me. I found the Moto slaughter tender, affecting and charming, just like I did the scene in Little House in the Big Woods.
Okay, well, I think it's probably time now, unless there's one last question, where we can adjourn and...
Can we all link hands? Led by the figure of death. Dance in silhouette down the Farringdon Road.
We could do that.
Yeah,
after you've done your signing. Oh, we could canvas opinion on that.
I told you I wasn't going to do the fucking signing.
But with that prospect in mind, maybe we could just thank Will very much for just coming and speaking so eloquently.
Guardian Unlimited.